It is a real pleasure to introduce Gary Langer again, and the polling results and data that he has produced on Afghanistan. I think it is particularly important because as we shift to a population-oriented strategy, the question is, what do we know about the population, about what the population thinks, about how it perceives what we're doing? And obviously, what we are talking about is preliminary, because we shifted our strategy and theory in the spring of last year, but to the extent we have actually begun to implement it, it occurred in the campaign in Marja this year in an extremely narrow and limited area. The first real test will probably come in Kandahar. The Helmand campaign did not have a major civil element. What people call shape, clear, hold, and build is still in its very initial stages. And Marja, to put it in perspective, is an area with about 80,000 people in it. It covers some 600 square kilometers, and we put some, depending on how you define it, 12,000 security forces and ISAF forces into that narrow area. So it is, in many ways, the first year in Afghanistan and the first implementation of the new strategy. The first impact on perceptions is still to come. And to introduce what Gary will be presenting in terms of popular attitudes, and the full set of these data is available in the handout that is on the sheet in the website, I did want to show what we are dealing with, because often it is not clear what we have said about the growth of the threat and the expansion of its area. These figures are taken from the work of Major General Flynn, who is the head of the intelligence group in ISAF. And I think it is important to see what has happened. This was not a critical insurgency, really, until 2006, 2007. And unfortunately, between 2001 and 2007, and the data are available elsewhere, we made no real effort to provide either the mix of NATO ISAF troops or anything approaching an effective Afghan force. When I was with the McChrystal Group in the summer of last year, we had less than a third of the required advisors to meet the need for training the Afghan army and police. We are now at the beginning of the spring of 2010, and we are still trying to work around the impact of some 9 years of neglect. And the end result has been things like the rise in IED attacks, but above all, this is the area of expansion where Gary has been polling, and I'm not going to take it beyond this, but I think it's critical to note what's happened. In 2004, there was one shadow government in an Afghan province. Today, there is a shadow government in every province but one. When you look at this, you see in the upper left-hand corner what happened in 2005. As you look down, you see what happened in 2007. When you look to the right, you see what happened in 2009. It would take a much larger graph to show how much worse things got in 2009. But another way of putting this is, since 2005, we have lost roughly 10 to 15% of the populated areas of Afghanistan to the influence of the Taliban every year. And as we look at what is happening, this shows you the intensity that occurred at the start of the Marja operation. The red areas are critical areas of Taliban influence. These show you the areas of influence by district. I will not take you further, but I do want to point out one thing that is, I think, critical. it isn't always obvious what these figures mean because you don't know where the population is. But if you look at this slide where the denser areas are the population centers, you see that you now have significant Taliban activity in virtually every populated area, and the Taliban activity is directly related to population density. So they moved into a population-oriented strategy some 4 years before the McChrystal strategy, President Obama's new strategy, became implemented. So this sets the stage for, I think, the question is, what do Afghans think? What do we know about what they think? What are the trends, and can we make any projections for the new strategy? And I can't think of anybody better to provide an overview than Gary Langer. He has been working at this issue for years, not only in Afghanistan, but Iraq. He has been, I think, one of the most objective critics of what polling can and cannot do, and someone who has spent a great deal on the correlation between polling and other forms of indicators. Gary?
Thanks for coming, everyone. It's a terrific opportunity to speak to a group with your level of interest and knowledge on a subject like this. I told Tony earlier, you try getting the attention of a television news producer on these subjects, and it's a little bit of a challenge. That's a short way of saying that I have a heinous number of slides, and I've instructed the staff to lock the doors. Let's pull it up. I'm going to run through these. I might do it a little more quickly than we'd like because I do want to preserve plenty of time for questions at the end. I do think it's really important and refreshing to note the extent to which both the sort of objective data that Tony so closely studies and reports to us and the practice of survey research have really increasingly joined hands, if you will, in terms of assessments of policy, strategy, and progress in Iraq and now in Afghanistan. There's an enormous amount of survey research being done in these countries. A little of it, by folks like me in the news media, really did sort of get a sense into the playbook of those who have far more data than we do. But many of the entities directly involved there are doing these sorts of assessments, marrying them up with external data and validities to sort of understand better how these strategies are working, how are they best structured, and what the response to them is. We've been trying to do this in Afghanistan now steadily over the last 5 years. This is our fifth in a series of national public opinion polls in Afghanistan. I do want to make a fundamental and essential point, which is simply that not all data are created equal. It is very easy, given the presumed authority with which data speak, to see a number and a percentage sign and get seduced by it, and to believe it and run with it and start forming judgment and policy on that basis. It is essential, I would suggest, in these data as in any data, to stop and evaluate how these numbers were produced, by what means and methods. We have detailed methodological disclosure of our approach up on our website at abcnews.com. You're welcome to email me with any questions you have about it, methodological or otherwise. I'm gary.langer@abc.com. But I would urge you in evaluating any data from any source to stop first, ask for a statement, a description of the methodology, and do that evaluation. It's essential. You can easily misinform rather than inform your judgment. Ours are national area probability samples, random selection households, individuals within household, and in-person interviews. The fifth in a series, as you can see, the latest data set was completed in late December. And I think it's also important to note that we've employed a consistent methodology as well as a rigorous run across each of these five surveys, which gives us a great deal of confidence in reporting trends over time. Some details about the methodology. Again, I'm hoping that CSIS will be able to put this presentation up on its website. So if you want to look into these in any greater detail. But this is the sort of level of explanation and disclosure, this and beyond, that I think is essential in any data you look at. 194 sampling points randomly selected by area probability, stratified urban-rural, proportionate to population size at the district level, simple random sampling at the settlement level. We did oversamples in selected provinces of interest so we could have a little more confidence in our analysis at that level. Area probability, random root, Kish grid. I can explain any of these, but I think one point in the third section there is that 31% of our interviews were either directly supervised or back-checked, which is a higher than normal level of back-check, and we do it again as another step in terms of the validation of our methodology. There is also extensive logical controls and data processing. This is a 32-minute interview with a good, robust response rate. The field work for these surveys is done for us, has been each time, by OXOR, the Afghan Center for Socioeconomic and Opinion Research. It's a subsidiary of D3 Systems in Vienna, Virginia. Their work and the work of the trained Afghan interviewers who produce these data are incalculably important. My contact and my project director at D3, when we first went over the methodology, he said it was worse than defending his thesis, which is what I try to do. But he put up with it, and we've created, I think, a remarkable data set as a result. In our most recent sample, there were sampling challenges, and I think it's important to be forthright about these sorts of challenges. Of the 101 randomly drawn districts in our sample, 11 turned out to be inaccessible for security reasons, about 10% of the sample. These are areas we couldn't get to, all right, safely with our interviewers, and the safety and security of our interviewers is paramount. They were replaced by random draw. We also couldn't do female interviews in three provinces, although they were particularly low population provinces. 10% of non-coverage is not ideal, but neither is it fatal. As you can imagine, it couldn't make more than 10 points of difference on a national level in any result. We wanted to evaluate what potential effect this non-coverage would have. We took our previous January 09 rather than this new December 09 data set, and we reevaluated it, removing the now inaccessible districts to see if it made any difference in our conclusions, and it made no substantive difference. Indeed, out of 144 variables we examined, only one reached a significant difference nationally, and only three in one region, the Southwest, and nothing else reached statistical significance. So that gave us essentially more confidence in the data set. Photos from the field, I just think it's really important and useful to remember that while survey results are expressed numerically, these are the expressions of the thoughts, experiences, hopes, and aspirations of a truly random sample of individuals around the country. You can see where our interviewers went and with whom they spoke, and I think it's a good reminder of the human element behind all of this work. It also reminds you it's a beautiful country. Okay, field reports came back. One of the things we do in addition to the quantitative data collection that we attempt is a little bit of qualitative work. We simply ask our interviewers in the field to give us some report, some assessment of their impressions of what they experienced when they were in the field. It's not hard data, it's not quantitative data, but it's useful, I think, as another element of assessment or understanding. And I've brought in some copies of the field reports. Again, these will be up on the website, so you need to read them all, but I suggest I'm going to give you a few pages on each page. Just pick a couple of paragraphs and give them a read to get a sense of what our interviewers experienced and reported in their own assessment on this project. The point is that these are, in sum, fairly positive assessments. And it's worth comparing them to a briefer sampling of some of the qualitative assessments we received from our interviewers in the field after our previous survey a year ago. Not conclusive by any means, but the qualitative assessments are useful in informing our judgments then about the data that we see. So what are our key findings? There's a lot of attention paid to this one. a dramatic increase in the sense among ordinary Afghans across the country that the country is moving in the right direction, a 30-point gain in this metric from our previous survey a year ago. There was some controversy associated with this result by some commentators who didn't like it, didn't meet their expectations. I try not to carry any expectations to our data. I let it talk to us. The question to me is not do I believe it or not, but where do I think it came from? What are the sources of these attitudes, this change in attitude? Some of the others we'll look at. How does it comport with other changes or lack of changes we see in our data set, and how do we come to understand it? One thing I can tell you is this change is not associated with this measure alone, but here are a few others. Okay, that blue line is still the increase in the sense that the country is going in the right direction. We also had a 20-point increase among Afghans in expectations that their own lives would improve in the next year, and a smaller but still a 14-point increase in the expectations of Afghans that their children would have a better life in the future. These are significant improvements in some basic metrics of living, not current conditions, but expectations for the future. And there were others as well. Positive ratings of Hamid Karzai's work as president, which had declined in each of our previous measures, rebound in this survey by a 19-point margin. Separately, 82% personal favorability for President Karzai, which is better than I get at home. There again is Karzai's 19-point gain in his positive rating, and again, other metrics associated with it show other improvements as well, not perhaps by as quite as wide a margin. Ratings of the Afghan army, a 13-point gain of the Afghan government in terms of their performance of their duties in the country. Interestingly, a much smaller advance in ratings of the performance of the United States in Afghanistan, far below the others, but one that does reverse steady declines that we saw in our previous 4 years of surveys. What are the factors that speak to us through the data that inform these changes in judgments? I'm going to walk you through them, but they include the advances in development, economic opportunity, for example, perhaps through these provincial reconstruction teams, the outcome, peaceful outcome of this election in which many Afghans have little experience, the assertion of strong leadership in a country that seems to value that attribute, and perhaps campaign-related expectations. There are a lot of promises made in election campaigns that raise expectations and often hopes for the future. Diminished blame to the United States, and I think therefore by extension to the national authority for civilian casualties occurring in the country, an essential element of progress. Strengthened U.S. commitment, and I would note that President Obama announced his increase in U.S. forces just a few weeks before our field period. And rising pressure on the Taliban, as experienced by the Afghan public, including the apparent increased participation of Pakistan, a country that has been very problematic in the eyes of many Afghans. There remain, we must be clear, great challenges. This is not a happy talk survey, as you'll see from our additional data. There are continued significant security concerns in the country, experience of violence and development needs, a very high level of corruption reported. There are very sharp regional differences, and we'll turn to this, which Tony mentioned, including far greater negativity in the south and east, the conflict zones, continued sensitivity to casualties and criticism of U.S. NATO-ISAF performance, and the challenge of revived expectations, because when expectations are not met, are not fulfilled, that can have an effect that can produce indeed a downward spiral, as we saw, for example, in Iraq. Now let's have some context for the gains. As some people contacted me and said, how is it possible that Karzai could be up 19 points? How is it possible that a right direction measure could be up 30 points? I just throw in some U.S. data for context here. In the few months after the presidential election, Barack Obama's personal favorability rating went up by 21 points. A positive election outcome with the culmination of a leader taking power can have a halo effect. Right direction. How could it be up 30 points in Afghanistan in a year? Well, in 6 months in the United States, right direction sentiment went up 42 points after the 2008 election. And indeed, most of that occurred in really just a three-month period after the inauguration. It's important to note at the same time that these sentiments are informed by situation on the ground, by facts and circumstances as they develop, and are not predictive of the future. Let's look at the right direction, wrong track measure here in the United States since that recent peak. And we see the dramatic increase after the 2008 election, and bang, that's its peak. The president takes ownership of the economy and heads back down. Wrong track resumes, and indeed not back where it was, but again is predominant in this country. Important that to keep that in mind, I think, as we look at our Afghan data. Okay, so what informs these changes we've seen? There are a variety of elements. I'd like to talk first about security. I think a key finding, if you look back and read it, of our January poll, was our finding about the corrosive effect of civilian casualties on support for U.S. and NATO ISAF efforts in Afghanistan. It was very clear that Afghans were unhappy, deeply so, with the level of civilian casualties, that they blamed them on the United States and NATO forces, and that where they occurred and where this blame occurred, a support for the presence of these forces, for the government, and many other aspects of our efforts there were far lower. It seemed to me in the ensuing months that General McChrystal read our data, or more likely, read his own. And it had must have had a very similar finding, because if you look at some of his comments from the beginning at his confirmation hearing and the focus he made on civilian casualties and on the effect they were having on U.S. efforts in Afghanistan, it seemed clear that these sort of data were informing these judgments. What's occurred? In the most recent, as far as I have it, United Nations assessment of civilian casualties in Afghanistan put out last September, they reported a 28% decline in civilian deaths attributed to ISAF and NATO forces. Still a large number, but substantially down in the past year, and an increase in the number attributed to anti-government forces, the Taliban and others. I find this data to be the sort of external validation for some of our survey results that we try to look for, that are helpful in understanding. And this effort, I think, to marriage external validation with survey data lends its support and credence. Because if you look here, concurrently with this decline by the UN's estimate of casualties associated with or caused by the Western allies, we see a dramatic change in public attitudes. An increase from 07 to 09 in the number of Afghans who mainly blame the U.S., NATO, and forces or the Afghan government for the violence that's occurring in the country, dropping off dramatically in 2009 to our new low level here, and the increase in blame on the Taliban for the violence that's occurring in the country. Specifically, when we ask about blame for civilian casualties in NATO air strikes, who do you blame more? The coalition forces for poor targeting or the anti-government forces for placing themselves among civilians and therefore placing civilians at harm? It's still not a very pretty picture. There's still plenty of blame, as you can see, for the U.S. and NATO forces and equally for both, but it has at least a little decline from a year ago. Airstrikes continue to be seen as unacceptable because they endanger civilians by a very broad majority of Afghans, although a slightly diminished one, which again comports with the notion that there are fewer civilian casualties being caused in these strikes. In a somewhat different kind of result, though, fewer Afghans say explicitly that the coalition forces are doing have gotten better in their efforts to avoid these casualties. More say they've gotten worse. Now, why is that result? I think there's a couple of reasons to look at. One is there may be a focus here on specific notorious incidents, particularly the Kunduz tanker. And there is, we saw in Iraq, and I think we might see in our data here, or be seeing in our data in Afghanistan as well, a reluctance, a hesitancy to credit U.S. and NATO forces with much of anything. And that is because of the dashed and diminished expectations. We went into Afghanistan with very high support. It was the poster child for U.S. popularity in a Muslim country. And those declined dramatically as this conflict continued and through the very slow pace of development in this country. It gets hard to turn around your assessment quickly. And therefore, we may see a continued period of grudging acceptance and support for U.S. forces and NATO, in many ways, regardless of other measures of progress. This is certainly what we saw in Iraq, where there's a much brighter outlook these days with very little or no credit given to the Western forces there. Ratings of local security stabilized this year after declining in our previous measures. Ratings of security from the Taliban or other armed groups is somewhat lower. Only about half the population feels secure from these groups. That's stable in the past couple of years. An experience of violence continues without any substantial change over our past measures. These are questions asking individuals if any of these have occurred nearby in their local area. As you can see, a substantial number report them with, as you might expect, great regional and provincial level differences. But this is a continued problem and certainly infects attitudes about the country. Okay, let's look at the U.S. and NATO ISAF a little more closely. Only 38% of Afghans give a positive rating to the performance of the United States in their country. Not a very good rating at all, but the first time in our measures that it hasn't declined. Nonetheless, look where it is from its peak. Those are those diminished and dashed expectations I was talking about a moment ago. Support for the presence of the United States also is leveled, slightly improved perhaps, and is much higher. I've had people ask me how this can be. How can you say we're doing a bad job but want us there? And I think that's pretty simple. I say, you know, you can decide that ABC News absolutely needs a public opinion pollster, but that Langer guy just doesn't cut it, right? So I think particularly when we see the preference of the U.S. and NATO forces to the alternative, you can understand the support for their presence, even while you have less than satisfactory assessments of their performance. A couple of other our measures are flattened. The notion that there's a strong local presence of these forces in your area stabilized after a decline, and the notion that they're effective in providing security. Some gains here, still well below their peaks. And concomitantly, we have some stabilization in favorable views of the United States overall. Look where it started. 83% of Afghans in our first survey there in 2005 expressed a favorable opinion of the United States. A remarkable number, again, for U.S. popularity in a Muslim nation, having thrown out the Taliban, which is a widely despised group, as we'll see. But that declined, and declined further, and declined in our most recent poll as the violence there increased. Note, by the way, how this has occurred since 2006, 2007, when, as Tony points out, the insurgency really took hold. But in this survey, it stabilizes. Still not a good number, and still not back where it's been, but it didn't get worse. As well, in the red line at the bottom, a decline in a sense that it's acceptable to or can be justified to attack U.S. forces to a new low in our data. An encouraging result that I think does comport with the others I've been showing you. Further, 61% of Afghans support the increase in U.S. forces in Afghanistan that's been announced. We can delve a little more deeply into this, although far fewer strongly support it, again, given the compunctions about the performance to date. Performance ratings are closely associated with the sense of presence, and I think this is an important measure to keep in mind. It's a data point we reported last year as well. Where the central government, this is particularly true of the Afghan government, is seen as having a strong presence. 69% of Afghans in those areas say it's doing a good job. Where it's seen as having only a fairly strong presence, that declines to 51%. Where it's seen as having a weak presence or none at all, only a third of Afghans or fewer approve of its performance. So presence informs substantive evaluations of performance. And the same, although to a lesser extent, is true of U.S. forces. Where they're seen as having a weak or no presence, they're half as likely to be rated positively in terms of their performance, the effectiveness of their work. Okay, but let's look for a minute at regional and provincial differences, which are very striking. experience of violence. Afghans who say there have been coalition airstrikes in their area in the past year look in the south and the east as compared to the rest of the country. Those who report civilian casualties that, in their assessment, they blame on these coalition forces, particularly in the south. It follows, naturally, perhaps, that support for the presence of U.S. forces is dramatically lower in these regions. Look at it in the south and east, the blue banner, the column there, compared to the rest of Afghanistan. Both support for their presence and confidence in the U.S. to provide security are far lower in these conflict areas. Again, blame for civilian casualties in airstrikes, far higher in the south and east in the level of blame apportioned to the U.S. and NATO forces than in the rest of the country. Less blamed on anti-government forces. These are challenging regions, as you can see. Consider Helmand. This is a little bit of a difficult table I'm going to show you, but given the Marja experience, I think it's important to keep in mind the very dramatic differences. Now, we have a small sample in Helmand, enough for me to present the data, but it's not going to be perfect. The differences here, and also given the inaccessibility we have in some regions, some areas within these conflict zones, the Helmand data are not going to be perfect, but they are highly suggestive, I think, of the differences in attitudes we have in some of these areas. People in Helmand province are 44 points more apt to report U.S. and NATO airstrikes in their area. 39 points, these are dramatic differences, more apt to support, to report civilian casualties caused, in their view, by the U.S. or NATO. Far less likely to give positive ratings to the central government, the performance of the U.S., the provincial government. 33 points less likely to support the presence of the United States in their country. All these go hand in hand. Less confident in security provided by the government, the central or provincial, the local police, the U.S. forces. If anyone had the great idea of going into margin saying, good news, people, we've brought the police with us, it might be useful to have this sort of data in hand before making that kind of decision. 55-point difference there. Local support for the Taliban, in terms of strong local support, is higher in Helmand than is local strong local support for the United States. And any local support, while higher for the U.S., is still substantial for the Taliban. Next. As Tony said, we look at Kandahar, the reportedly next focus, and we see it's a shorter list, but we see, again, many of these same dramatic differences in experience of violence, in blame for civilian casualties, an essential metric, and then in views of the U.S. in terms of our performance and support for the U.S. and Taliban. People in Kandahar, the home of the Taliban, 34 points less likely to see it as the country's biggest threat. I want to stress some of these Taliban data, so I just put these some of these back together into a chart for you here. Strong local support for the United States is 18% in Kandahar and Helmand versus 42% in the rest of the country. For the Taliban, you can see the strong local support, 1 in 4 in Helmand and Kandahar versus 1 in 10 in the rest of the country. And then when we add in any local support, any more than none that's reported, again, it's vastly higher in Helmand and Kandahar for the Taliban and lower for the United States. Let's talk a little more about the Taliban. Who do you prefer to rule Afghanistan? We've had a very consistent result. The current government is vastly preferred to the Taliban. Favorable opinion of the Taliban has been pretty stable and not particularly high. I'm sorry, these are national. I beg your pardon. We're back to national here. It's a little higher in Kandahar, as I just showed you. This is the back to national data. We ask Afghans what they think is the country's greatest threat. Overwhelmingly, the top open-ended mention is the Taliban. Actually, I beg your pardon. It's not an open-ended question. It's a listed choice. And that's actually increased a bit in the last year. Another important measure, particularly given what we know about views of the Taliban and the change in attitudes, the increase in hopefulness for the country's direction, I think, is further informed by this result, in which we see a sense that the Taliban have, in fact, grown weaker over the past year, a 16-point increase from January 2009 to December 2009, in the sense that the Taliban have grown weaker, and substantially fewer thinking that they've grown stronger. And still a substantial sense, but a diminished sense, that Pakistan is allowing the Taliban to operate within its borders. This is a kind of measure I'd like to ask again, given the even more recent events we've heard about. But a 14-point drop in suspicion is not insubstantial, that the Pakistan is acting in some degree in concert with the Taliban. A further cause for some of the improvements in broader optimism, I think, that we see in our measures, in some of our measures. A rebound, therefore, in views that the U.S.-led overthrow of the Taliban was a positive thing for the country. It's been majority across the line, but given the increased concerns we saw a year ago, it had tailed off somewhat and now has rebounded. A steady result from last year, 2/3 of Afghans think ultimately that the government should negotiate a settlement with the Taliban, although the vast majority of those say that should only occur after the Taliban lay down their arms. Doesn't seem likely. There's a bit of an increase in the sense that ultimately the Afghan government will prevail, a steady sense that there will be some sort of negotiated settlement, and a bit of a decline in the notion that the fighting will simply drag on. Okay, talk about the election for a minute. I pointed this out earlier as a source of greater hope. There was a rally behind Karzai, perhaps unexpected given the nature of the election and the way in which it was ultimately decided. So was there fraud in the election? Significant majorities of Afghans say yes, there was fraud in the voting, in their view, and there was fraud in the vote count, but substantially fewer in both cases think it was widespread fraud. Eight in ten, perhaps, therefore, report confidence that democracy can work in their country, and most strikingly, 3/4 declare themselves as satisfied with the outcome of the election. I think there's relief that the election was settled without violence, without civil war, that you got through it, you got a leader, you can go forward. There are certainly many challenges that continue and remain in terms of governance in this country, and here's a good example of that. Note the increase. While we've seen other improvements since 2007, we see the opposite trend in terms of a sense of the extent of local corruption and the seriousness of the problem. 95% is getting near as close to as you can get to unanimous. Development is another key measure in terms of overall public attitudes. It informs the population's sense of where their country is going and what their future may hold. The top blue line is ratings of your local living conditions, positive or negative. They declined in each of our measures over the past 4 years, but this year we see a rebound. Now, what might inform that improved sense of local living conditions, ratings of living conditions? We can break it down into some individual measures. Freedom of movement has at least stabilized after declining. We see now not a 1 year, but a 2 year improvement in the ratings of local infrastructure, including roads and bridges and the like. It seems as if development efforts are starting to gain traction. Support for agriculture, positive ratings of the economy more moderately up, and finally, in a very important measure, the provision of electricity. This can be power line, but it's frankly more likely to be either personal or shared generator, but we see improvement there. And these are measures that affect, in many ways, the daily lives of the population. All of these, ultimately, are pointing up. And that's a positive change from some of the previous measures, particularly in living conditions overall. This is further supported when we ask people if there's been any development in the last five years, in terms of, we use a variety of measures, but these are the two that stood out. An increased number of Afghans report road building in their area, and an increased number report the construction of health clinics. These are the sorts of activities that reach people where they live and that can contribute to attitudinal changes more broadly. Positive ratings of the economy, while they've been up and down, are at a bit of a high, and certainly you're up from where they were at a year ago. This is jobs, the availability of jobs and economic opportunity. Let's look more broadly at the demographic profile of the population. It's important to keep these sorts of measures in mind. It's a young population, ill-educated, rural, with a lack of many amenities, except cell phones. It's interesting. We saw a very similar measurement in Iraq, where cell phone ownership went to basically no one over the course of our 6 years of polling there to almost everyone. It's a dramatic change, and I think that can have an impact and effect on your daily life in a profound way. So we want to predict. We do something called a regression analysis, in which we put in a variety of variables, trying to predict an outcome, holding each variable constant, which one independently predicts the outcome. We did it for each of these measures, right direction, positive U.S. ratings, presence of forces. I won't bore you with the specific equations, although I'll be happy to email it to you if you'd like to see it. In predicting right direction, since that was our most dramatic change, we built a range of models, six different models with a variety of items. The R-squareds, that's the amount of variance explained in the model, was pretty substantial. There's still unexplained variance in a good deal of it, but for a model, this is pretty good. What was significant across each of these models? What are the individual elements that predict a sense that the country is heading in the right direction? Those are ratings of local conditions overall, an index of rebuilding, a sense of security from the Taliban or blame of the Taliban for violence, a negative indicator, freedom of movement, satisfaction with the election and or confidence in President Karzai, positive views of the U.S., and positive ratings of income or household finances. Each of these, using many of the other measures I've shown you this morning, independently predict a sense that the country is moving in the right direction. One thing this tells us, although I think we know it by now, is there is no one silver bullet in terms of addressing the problems and public perceptions of the problems in Afghanistan. It's about development. It's about security. It's about freedom of movement. It's about economic opportunity, and it's about support for the government. When we predict positive ratings of the performance of the United States in Afghanistan, the ones that jump out as significant are the presence of these forces in your local area. When they're there, you're more confident in them. Ratings of jobs and economic opportunity, and again, the index of rebuilding. And predicting support, that first is a performance rating, the second is support for the presence of these forces, rebuilding, and an index of local violence are independent predictors of these attitudes. Okay, I have a few end notes and then I'll be done. There's some odds and ends that I think are worth keeping in mind. One is when we think about Afghanistan, we have to recognize that this is not Kansas. And there are many social and cultural differences, some of which I think I've laid out for you already, but a few others that I would just point out to keep in mind. We ask Afghans what political system they prefer, an Islamic state in which a group of religious leaders makes the final decisions politically for the country, a democratic state in which elected leaders make the final decisions for the country, or a strong leader who makes the decisions, rules for life, and makes the decisions independently. And the preferred system of government in Afghanistan is an Islamic state. We've asked a very similar question to this over the years in Iraq, and we've seen some changes in Iraq, but also differences that are worth keeping in mind. In Iraq, by contrast to Afghanistan, we've always seen more preference for democracy than the other options. We also saw some diminished preference for democracy when things got really bad in Iraq, and a sharp rebound in preference for democracy when things improved. It's also important, of course, to keep in mind in Iraq that there were very dramatic differences in these views among the ethno-sectarian groups there. Kurds, much more interested in democracy, Sunnis in a strong leader, and Shiites to some extent in Islamic State, but ultimately plurality preference and in our last poll, majority preference for democracy. A difference from Afghanistan, and one worth keeping in mind, I think. Moving to a social front, I think you might have noticed in my other data the percentage of Afghan women who hold jobs outside the home, 7%. Attitudinally, urban women in the country are very different from other groups in terms of their strong support for the concept of women holding jobs outside the home, 73% compared to urban men. Rural women, rural men, keep in mind 80% of the Afghan population is rural. Who should decide whether a woman wears the burqa, the woman or her husband or father? The country splits on that. Majority of men say the husband or father should decide, and a majority of women. I'm not trying to start anything here. But still, 42% of Afghan women say the husband or father should decide. A moment on opium. United Nations Office of Drugs and Crime reported earlier this fall in September a significant drop in the cultivation of opium poppy in Afghanistan, 22% drop in Helmand, the ground zero of opium poppy production, a 33% drop. Less of a decline in production of opium itself because of greater, I guess, efficiency, but still declines in these, and it credited political leadership, better enforcement, and promotion of alternative crops. Attitudinally, again, in what I take as a source of external validity for our results, we see a dramatic change in the opium-growing regions. A drop in Helmand, very substantial drop, in the sense of the population that it's acceptable to cultivate opium if there's no other way of making a living. A drop as well, concurrently, in the next six top opium-producing provinces, although far and away most of it comes from Helmand, while it's been stable and far lower in the rest of Afghanistan. A bit of a success story there, it looks like, at least attitudinally. And finally, in terms of national identity and confidence in institutions, these are two last points I'll leave you with. One is there's always been a sense or a suggestion that Afghans are not really Afghans, that they think of themselves not in terms of any national identity, but are much more apt to define themselves in terms of their tribal group, the Pashtun, Tajik, Hazara. We ask this question. We ask them their ethnic group or their tribal group, and then we ask them, do you think of yourself more or first as an Afghan or as a member of their group? And two-thirds think of themselves as Afghans first, so there is some indication of a national cohesiveness or identity there. And additionally and finally, in terms of public confidence and support for institutions, we find very high confidence and support for the Afghan government overall, police and the provincial governments, far lower, this is national data, as noted, for coalition forces, local militia, and lowest of all for the Taliban. But to the extent to which a functioning government relies on the consent of the governed, we do see some positive data here for the future. The question is whether this confidence is earned and can be retained by the current government and its Western allies. Thank you very much.
Ladies and gentlemen, let me remind you that the details will be up on the web, and we will provide both the trends in the force and Gary's presentation. I would also ask that if you have a brilliant technical question on the subject of polling, you email Gary, because the answers are almost as long as the questions, and it is very difficult. In general, if I could ask that each person ask one question with one part, since I have noticed that people have gotten around the one question with nine-part questions, please look around you. We don't have time for interesting speeches, but the steps outside are available for those of you who wish to give one. And finally, if I may, as you ask a question, would you please identify yourself and your organization? With those limited caveats, who would like to start, please, in the front row?
Mike Delaney.
Wait for the microphone, please, if you don't mind.
Mike Delaney, Office of the U.S. Trade Representative. It has been my experience in southern Afghanistan that there is a fairly strong positive correlation between tribal or subtribal affiliation and support for the Taliban. Have you tried to inject a tribal or subtribal dimension into your polling?
We have to some extent, although I haven't gotten a lot out of it, and it may be simply a function of sample size, right? But one thing, of course, is you've got there's not a lot of variation in terms of ethnic identity. There's subtribal differences, but there are not a lot of Hazaras in Helmand, for example, right? We ask ethnicity, and then we did ask a tribal element, or Durrani, et cetera, but our sample sizes aren't really adequate for provincial-level analysis of that data, much less, not provincial, not even regional. And nationally, we don't see substantial differences, in Durrani versus other Pashtun, for example. But it's a good question. And by the way, I really value this part of the presentation because I can take some of these suggestions, run our data, see if indeed we do see something, and be happy to share that with you if it shows up.
The gentleman in the second row over there.
I'm Malachi Nugent from the Treasury Department. You mentioned that 80% of the Afghan population is rural, and one of the things that we're looking at Treasury is expanding the reach of the formal financial sector out to those rural populations. And one question that we have, though, is to what extent do rural populations look to formal institutions based in Kabul, based in the cities, for services, for public services? To what extent do rural populations look to the formal financial sector, or would they look to the formal financial sector as opposed to traditional lending arrangements, and then extending that not just to financial systems but to other public services as well?
Yeah, I would say you should do a poll on that. These are specific topics to which you could get excellent data. All I would be able to give you are suggestive data. But certainly the changes that we see have to occur in rural areas. There's not enough people in the urban areas to drive these differences. So the improvements in ratings of local conditions, the index of rebuilding that I discussed, the greater sense of some jobs and economic opportunity clearly do exist. The improvements have occurred in rural areas, at least as much, if not more, than in urban areas. But in terms of specifics on the interest and reliance in microfinance or other sorts of loans, you'd have to go in and do that. But the guys from D3 are over there. You could get together.
Let me just comment that there is a problem in defining rural areas. Some are near roads. Some are relatively dense because they're in river valleys. Others are highly dispersed. One answer to your question that would come, I think, from talking to Canadian, British, and other aid workers in the PRTs is that anything that's more than 2 hours walk, which is often the practical test, isn't accessible. But the question is, who is 2 hours walk from what? And mapping that is not something where it's easy to generalize by going urban to rural. Let's see, the second row, the gentleman there.
Chris DeAngelis, also from the Office of U.S. Trade Representative. I'll be going out to Pakistan in the summer. So I'm wondering, one of the key issues we've heard is problems with justice and the judiciary functioning effectively, particularly in the countryside. And that's one reason it seems that, these people turn to the Taliban because they can get something done, even if it's not, it's some rough justice, but they can get something done. And do you have any data on how people perceive the justice system working and the government's role in it?
Yeah, sadly, I don't. And the reason is we made a specific decision not to go there because it's a complex enough area of questioning that you can't do it in a question. You would need a battery to really pick apart the concerns and the solutions that are in place and the preferences for alternatives. And this was about a half-hour questionnaire, which is about as long as we can comfortably go without getting respondent fatigue. And others have done longer, and I start worrying about data quality. The Asia Foundation has done survey research in Afghanistan that tends to be less focused than ours on political issues and on broader public attitudes, and does drill down to some extent into social preferences and concerns. And that may be a place to look if you check their website.
There's another way to look at this. There have been surveys done within the embassy and within the various aid teams. Basically, you have at this point something approaching a court presence. That doesn't necessarily mean it's effective, but approaching something like a judicial system that affects about 9% of the population. So just in a very crude sense, is there anybody there doing anything? Those are mapped, and the answer is it affects maybe 10% of the population on a functional level. Let's see. There's the young lady in the third row there.
Hi, Anika Arabitsans, Counterpart International. What was the percentage of women respondents in your sample, and also how were you able to reach women?
Okay, so the sample is about 50-50, men and women. We send out separate teams of male and female interviewers to conduct interviews of male respondents and of female respondents. But the ultimate ratio is 50. The women interview teams, I should say, are escorted, of course. But they only women interview women, and only men interview men, I believe. And indeed, we have separate sampling points for men and women in order to prevent rivalry. But yeah, it does reflect, the survey across the board reflects as best we can the population values in the country. One of the challenges is the population values in the country are a little sketchy, right? There hasn't been a census done in Afghanistan since 1979, I believe. But we do have a CSO, a Central Statistic Office, estimates of the population and the distribution of the population. And those include the roughly 50-50 division of men and women, which we then reflect in our sampling.
The gentleman in the third row in the center. Incidentally, I have a blind spot on the left, so please raise your hand because I can't see you otherwise.
Marvin Weinbaum, the Middle East Institute. Probably one of the most surprising findings that you have is the popularity of Karzai, which is obviously, I think you reflected that in your remarks, particularly because of our concern about the legitimacy of the government, central government, how important that is in terms of support for our counterinsurgency. Trying to understand that further, is it possible that many of the respondents saw that as, do you prefer Karzai to the alternative? So that it was, in a sense, their choice, their Karzai or someone else. And also, is there some explanatory value in the fact that it is well noted that in the move up to the election, Karzai deliberately, in good fashion, political fashion, went and spent a lot of money in the development area. Clearly, people are, especially with electricity, are experiencing a better outcome because of that.
Right, and has a strong effect. And I think I mentioned that, or tried to mention that the effect of campaign promises can have a positive impact on
Or delivery, yeah, actual delivery.
Delivery as well, on expectations and on assessments as well. We asked about Karzai both directly and elliptically, if you will, in a variety of ways, and the data are pretty consistent. We ask about his personal favorability. We ask, as we have consistently now for 5 years, about ratings of the performance of the government he leads. And we ask about, not about Karzai, simply, are you satisfied or dissatisfied with the outcome of the election? A question that we didn't want to tie to Karzai, again, to see if we get any difference. And we get consistent readings across. I would, again, there is a halo effect of winning, of emerging victorious from a period of conflict, even if an election conflict, if you will, that we've seen in previous cultures, including our own strange culture. So that certainly is not unheard of by any means. Separately, this is a society that seems to, I don't want to go too far beyond our data, that I think can be said to value strong and assertive leadership. And the emergence of a strong and assertive leader after a period of uncertainty, again, can indeed inform positive ratings of that leader. The question is, do they stay positive? President Obama's gone from 69% approval to around 50. It depends on performance, and that's why it's necessary to continue to take these measurements and assess in an ongoing way.
The gentleman in the back row.
Phil Mastretta, Office of the Special IG for Iraq. Are you still polling in Iraq, and how much comparative analysis do you do between Iraq and Afghanistan? I noticed one or two slides on this point, but it's become quite a cottage industry here inside the Beltway.
Yeah, it's true. My last poll in Iraq was about a year ago, and I'm always looking for another opportunity and the right time. We've in the past polled around the anniversary of the invasion, but very frankly, the elections were in the way this time. I didn't want to poll in the midst of the national elections there, which I would have needed to do to get results in time for the anniversary of the invasion, so we let that go. We do have continued interest in conducting surveys in Iraq, but it's obviously of less pressing, if I may say, news value, which I have to keep in mind given my employer. But I think it's important. The value we can provide in doing these independent surveys as news organizations is by opening a window that many of the decision makers in our government, frankly, already have open and are looking out. There is a lot of data available in Iraq and Afghanistan, but not a lot publicly available. And I think by doing this, we can get a better public understanding by disseminating these data of the decisions that are being made and the information that's informing them. And that's frankly why we do it, why I think it's an important project, and I'd like to continue it. I've not done a lot of comparison, some general stuff, but we've seen similar trends to some extent in Iraq and Afghanistan. In Iraq, as you know, some reasonably high expectations, and no one was, well, other than Sunnis, no one was glad to see. It was sad to see Saddam gone. But then that spiral of despair in that country as it fell into sectarian violence after the Samarra bombing, and then a dramatic recovery in our last poll, which I suspect is continued because violence is lower and there's a greater sense that the country is going to stay together. But there are very fundamental differences. The attitude driver in Iraq in many ways was the sectarian attitudes, the Kurds and the Sunnis and the Shiites, and the question is whether they could find some accommodation. That's much less the case. There's much more uniformity across groups in our data in Afghanistan, and it's much more about the level of violence, the development, and the other measures I've discussed.
I should note that both the State Department in dealing with Iraq and the State Department in dealing with Afghanistan is zero-basing its models of how to measure progress in both countries with new polling elements as well as fixed indicators, which is kind of interesting after 9 years. It is truly zero-basing. It is also doing so without any coordination with the rest of the United States government or between the Iraqi and Afghan efforts to see if there are areas of common effort. So let me note that your question is a very good one, but I would be much happier if the United States government showed even the slightest interest in coordinating within itself. The lady in the back there.
Read our latest white paper.
I have unfortunately read the latest papers from State and Defense as of this week. They have evidently not read your white paper. All right.
I'd love for you to send it to
the
me.
Lady in the back row.
Gail Morgado from SCRS, Coordinator for Reconstruction and Stabilization within the Department of State. My question is, you spent a lot on public perception on military forces and the U.S. as a whole, but what about, did you ask about what the perception was of civilians working in the field and of the U.S. as well as international community that's there and is ramping up, and if that's noted by Afghans at large, or if that's simply not.
Yeah, we had a favorability rating, I believe, of, I don't know if we did NGOs, but we did of the United Nations, I believe, the performance of the UN. Let me see if I can find it for you. Here it is, sure. And it was a little underwhelming. We asked ratings of the presence and the performance of foreign aid organizations. Half of Afghans, this would make more sense too if we dissected it regionally, but half of Afghans said there was a strong presence of foreign aid organizations in their area. About half said there was not. And uh, and we didn't do a lot of other metrics on it. You know, our report is up at abcnews.com. Our questionnaire, again, even in a presentation of this detail, I can't hit it all because it's a half-hour interview, of 60 or 70 item questionnaire. But the full questionnaire and the marginal results are up at our website in this document. You're welcome to take a look at. And I'm happy to run any cross-tabulations anyone's interested in. So you can look through our questionnaire and say, what did that look like in the Southeast or in Kunduz? And we can run that data. I'm happy to do it.
Again, I'd be very cautious about this. Where efforts were made last year to map where the civilian aid workers were and where they reached out to. When you talk about polling nationally, you have to understand that the actual presence of civilian aid workers in the field, which is very different from seeing a project somewhere, is very limited in terms of most of Afghanistan. The other is that when you ask questions like civilian versus military or U.S. versus international components of ISAF, often people think U.S. as ISAF unless they happen to know it's German or Swedish or what have you. Nationality differences and perceptions are extremely uncertain. So when you start doing French, German, and U.S. presence in Afghanistan, you're more likely to get misleading than positive results.
Yeah, we've tried some of that, and it's essentially the same. In other words, if you ask about the performance of the United States or you ask about the performance of NATO ISAF, we have those separate measures, and they're almost identical. I think they're conflated.
The gentleman in back.
Jim Durrell from Office of Military Affairs at AID. I enjoy your polls. Two things I'd like to ask you, not in numerous parts. One, you've got some data on development, and things are going up. And I'd ask, so what? Dr. Korsman's talked about this all the time in his stuff about just having metrics of output things. Second thing is I'd ask, when you looked at favorable responses to Taliban, did you get a sense of why? Why?
Well, two things. So first, in terms of development improving, as we show in our regression analysis, it is a significant predictor of positive public attitudes in terms of sense the country's going the right way, confidence in the government, in the U.S. and NATO as well. I think it's an essential element, in fact, of public confidence and attitudes more broadly, where development is seen as occurring. I think this was the promise, or at least the perceived or taken promise, of the invasion. The notion that, A, the yoke of the Taliban would be removed, and, B, that much-needed development in a very impoverished country would follow, and that slow pace of the development, in addition to the ongoing violence, has been one of the great sources of frustration among the population. So to see those improve does, in a very important way, I think, inform our broader judgment and understanding of how people are reacting to the situation. There's nothing like local development that is going to hit you personally, that's going to affect your personal life. If you've got electricity when you didn't, a road so you can get to the market in a few hours rather than a few days, all these make very important differences in living conditions and therefore are reflected in attitudes. I'm sorry, your second...
Does that lessen support for the Taliban? I mean, we can do all these things, but there's a lesson support for the Taliban. That's what we're trying to do.
Right.
Why is Taliban traction here? Because they're not providing jobs programs, putting girls in school, to the roads.
Right. Support for the Taliban, A, is not at all broad around the country. It peaks in conflict zones, and there may be some cultural or religious or political reasons for that. But in Kandahar, it's the birthplace of the Taliban. It's where they're from, and it's where their support is essentially strongest. I don't know that would be a surprise, a cultural an allegiance that's related to a variety of preferences. But also that these are the areas where not only is development challenged, but where violence is highest. And where violence is highest, people are going to look to some solution to that violence. And if they don't see it coming from one source, there may be an increased inclination to seek it from another.
It's drawn from a different source, but I think we need to be extremely careful here. First, the Taliban does provide key jobs for young men, and until really late in 2009, it was paying more than the local police or the army was. So it was a major employer. Prompt justice is, for many Afghans, the key to local stability. The Taliban was covering about five times the area that the Afghan government was in terms of this, because we focused on formal justice systems rather than traditional justice systems. And the other problem is, when you talk about Taliban presence, you have to remember that, and again, the maps here are not generally distributed, and in an awful lot of areas, the Taliban is the only presence. There is no competing Afghan government presence of any kind whatsoever. So when we talk about Taliban versus NATO ISAF or JIROA, we have to keep in mind exactly what the areas are and these. And I think one of the great problems we have had in general is the failure, just in the crudest terms, to map where we are active or the Afghan government is active. Because quite aside from the qualitative issue, if you're not there at all, strangely enough, you're not taken very seriously.
Again, as I think the table I showed you, our data suggests that attitudinally, it's very clear that where you're seen as having a strong presence, or any presence, you're much more likely to be rated positively for your performance. You'd be in real trouble if the opposite were the case, of course.
Let's see. Let me take the question over here on the left. Sorry, I couldn't see it.
Craig Adair, just an interested member of the public. I have a follow-up question on ethnicity, and if that's, if I understood your response earlier, that your sample sizes weren't large enough, but the numbers that you did get didn't pick up significant differences across ethnicity. If that's the case, how do you, or do you have any explanations to offer for the difference that you, the clear difference that you saw in the South and the East?
Yeah, there are regional differences. I haven't teased out if those are ethnic or regional differences, and we could run the data to establish whether, you're right, the Pashtun in the South has, you know, as opposed to Hazara and Tajiks in the North, that may well be associated. I don't know if it's regional or ethnic, and it's an analysis I haven't done, but it's one worth doing. Initially in Iraq, for example, there were suggestions that the differences we saw there attitudinally were regionally based rather than ethnically or ethno-sectarian based, and we could dispel that pretty quickly when we ran that data. It was clearly ethno-sectarian. There are some, I mean, I shouldn't say we haven't seen any differences. I haven't seen any that have risen a level for me to spend a lot of time on them. Rural Pashtuns are more conservative, more negative about the government to some extent, particularly rural, to the extent I've looked at them, rural Pashtun men. I haven't done an in-depth analysis of those. We've got, by the way, a good, robust data set now. We can combine these surveys and look at some of the basic metrics over time. And even though we've had change in the outcome, we can therefore increase the sample and look at some of the individual groups, and differences among groups can stand out better.
Ladies and gentlemen, I think we have kind of run over the normal hour, but let me take one last question. I think the gentleman in the second row there, if you'd.
Vijay Nilekani, NEI. Did the scope of your survey include perception of neighboring countries? Like, what do the Afghans think of the Iranians or the Tajiks or Uzbeks or Chinese or Indians?
Yeah, we did include some favorability ratings of other countries. And consistently in our data, the country that is seen most favorably by Afghans, this should not be a surprise, I hope, is India. And I think that's because India is seen as a counterweight to the Pakistanis, who are viewed with a great deal more suspicion. There's that lessened sense that Pakistan is harboring the Taliban, but there is still not a lot of warm feeling about Pakistan. As I check our data, 81% of Afghans see Pakistan unfavorably. I guess you could look on the bright side and note that it was 91% the last time we asked.
How about the Iranians?
Yeah, we didn't ask about China. We got an even split on Iran, half see Iran favorably, about half unfavorably. And again, the one that really jumps out at me is India, 71% favorable.
Ladies and gentlemen, thank you very much for coming, and may I ask you to thank Gary in the sort of traditional manner.
Thank you.